first thing I would do is read emails from people who needed help. You know, there's over 100 million people who are getting Medicare and Medicaid and ACA. And, you know, that just sort of centered me.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and I'm really excited to introduce you to a very special episode. Today, I got to interview Andy Slavitt. Andy worked in the Obama administration as the administrator for CMS, which is a center for Medicare and Medicaid, and led the team that helped fix the rollout of healthcare.gov. 5 years ago, graduated from Northwestern with a master's in health communication. I chose to get a master's in health communication because I wanted to solve problems in healthcare. I saw that as someone who worked in communications, the problems, important problems that could be solved with communications, improved communications, were in the healthcare sector. My career has not really taken me down the road of using that degree in a very clear way. One of the things that going to school for health communications did for me was it changed who I followed on Twitter. I started following people who were disability rights activists, healthcare policy wonks, government people, private sector, individuals, organizations. And Andy Slavitt is someone that I've probably followed him for 5 or 6 years already because I really admire the work that he did. And he's been the person, and I shower him with compliments during the interview. I find him to be someone with a clear moral compass, which is lacking in national leadership at the time. And so while this podcast, normally I ask people to come on and talk about one of their favorite things, something pop culture. If you go on my archives, you'll find interviews about Star Wars, about Legion of Superheroes, how to be a DJ. It's a really usually very fun, kind of lighthearted pop culture things that people love. But I decided having a podcast also meant that I could reach out and ask the people who are some of my favorites to learn more about what makes them tick. So this is not the normal interview that I do for this podcast, but you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And met Andy in Chicago a few years ago and have just admired how he supported the Affordable Care Act after when Trump became president, and the work he's doing on a daily basis to try and pull us out of this death spiral on COVID. So this is a conversation with someone who I admire. At the end, I do ask for a pep talk for those of us who are making decisions about how to celebrate High Holy Days. I'm president of a synagogue. So the very end of this podcast is for the rabbis and cantors and synagogue lay leaders that I know who are looking for, I don't know, a pep talk from someone that we see on the news. Thank you for checking out this episode of Finding Favorites and this special interview with Andy Slavitt, who is one of my favorites. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Yeah. Tell me about your podcast.
So the podcast is called Finding Favorites, and I interview people about their favorite thing, how they found it, why they love it, and kind of what it has taken them to.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea.
Thank you. It's algorithm-free recommendation.
I love it.
Thank you.
Are you going to turn it into an algorithm and make $1 billion off of that?
You know, look, if it happens, if I make $1 billion, then I'll get to prove that I'm a good billionaire and pay my taxes and do a lot of philanthropy. That's the goal, right?
Excellent. Yeah. Sounds great to me.
So normally I asked people to pick a favorite thing and talk about it. So I want to give a little bit of context, which is that we met in 2018
when you were doing a campaign event for Renato Mariotti in Evanston.
I remember meeting you.
And so I have a master's in health communication and graduated 5 years ago from Northwestern and probably started following you on Twitter then.
When I had one follower.
Yes. Right. In the before times.
Right. In the before times.
And I have just admired, it just felt like so many people when the administration changed, stopped doing their public service and you never stopped. So while normally I would say, Andy, pick a movie that you love and let's talk about that for an hour. I wanted to talk about why you love public service. Like why? So less about COVID and more you've continued fighting to maintain access to healthcare policies, educate people since you left the Obama administration. And so I'm really curious why you've stuck with it and like, what are the values that keep you mm-hmm. fighting for healthcare in this country?
Well, it's nice of you. Really nice of you, but you know, I have a lot of privilege. I mean, you know, I can do this cause I don't have to fight to put meal on the table. I don't have to fight to take care of a ailing child every day. I don't have to balance a job or more than one job and raising my kids. I don't have to worry about health insurance. Yeah, we're also increasingly in these times aware, supposed to be aware of our privilege. And I can assure you, I'm not always the best at doing that. I'm sure there's a lot of things I've taken for granted. But I tell you, just to be very blunt, you know, there's no better feeling than helping people. I mean, and I mean that in a selfish sense, not just in an altruistic sense, although I'm really glad it can play out in ways that do help people. But, you know, I used to wake up every day in the Obama administration and, you know, I first thing I would do is read emails from people who needed help. You know, there's over 100 million people who are getting Medicare and Medicaid and ACA. And, you know, that just sort of centered me. You know, I would really miss feeling like I was not able to do that, particularly, and I think it would be wrong, given how much fortune I've had.
Right, because you were in health technology before you were kind of called up to serve in the CMS, right?
I had a private sector career for, you know, 20 years. And I got involved in the government because they needed help because the website healthcare.gov had crashed. And I called them, which I know sounds weird and it's a little bit stupid, but I called them on a Tuesday and asked if they needed help. And on Friday, they announced that I was going to lead the turnaround of the website. And the president then afterwards asked me if I would join the administration.
Wow, that was fast. So you put together, man, is Paul Smith, was he on your team?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. So I know Chicago Tech people who worked on the Obama campaign in 2012. And so I met him, like I loosely know him through that social circle.
He's a great guy. Yeah. He's big help.
So you pulled together that team.
Well, I didn't recruit Paul. I mean, Paul in that some of the tech people were recruited by other people. I oversaw that team. I oversaw the government contractors. And then I brought in about 200 of my own people that worked for me. And so then, you know, then I basically just oversaw the whole thing. But people like Paul and a few of his colleagues were just instrumental in the kind of technical savvy that they brought that we really needed.
Had you worked in public service before you called the president?
No. I mean, I'd been interested. And I probably assumed I would someday. You know how like you have these, you know, you have this sense, you never know how life's going to turn out.
Yeah.
But it's not like anybody who met me was like shocked.
Right.
Right. My wife and I are both, you know, politically active. She's very grassroots, politically active. I'm a little more policy, politically active. And we always have been, you know, I grew up in a house that I grew up in Chicago. And I don't know if I ever told you that, but in a house that was focused on social justice and good values. And my wife grew up, very lower middle class, not necessarily political, but, she got where she got in life because of public programs. She's not one of those people who think she was, did it all on her own. She's one of those people who understands that you got to offer people help. So when I told her, I said, I'm going to go to Washington and try to turn around this website. She just looked at me and said, don't come back till it's fixed.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Good support.
So you were with the Obama administration from the launch of the Affordable Care Act, well, from the turnaround of the Affordable Care Act and healthcare.gov through the last day of the administration, right?
That's right.
And then there was a gap before you started US of Care. So the privilege that you have allowed you to stay in the fight, and kind of ahead of launching US of Care, it just seemed like you were this one man lobbying machine who still believed in bipartisan cooperation, who continued to use your connections on the Hill and in the private sector to keep the Affordable Care Act front and center, to help people understand that, when I talk to my friends about supporting the Affordable Care Act, I talk about the importance of, Chicago only has the entrepreneurial center it has today between, matter is healthcare, 1871 is technology. It can only exist because we can get healthcare on the exchange. So if you want to destroy the economy, destroy the creative class, you take away access to healthcare, because then people have to take jobs because their health insurance is tied to their employment, instead of having the creativity that the exchange allows us. So, like, how did people react when you stayed in it? I know how I reacted as a policy fan of yours, but on the Hill and in DC, how did people react that you didn't leave?
Well, so the truth is that I wasn't the only one by a long shot. I was one of many, 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 many people. And, I had Andrew Yang on my podcast that actually came out today. And it's interesting because we were, I was talking to him about universal basic income and UBI, and he said, look, you showed me something. I hadn't met him before, but he said, you showed me something, which is that a movement has to be associated with a person for it to happen. And that's how I'm trying to be with UBI. And he said, that's how you've been with healthcare rights. And so I became perhaps the most visible person in this effort, but a whole lot of people, including a number of my colleagues from the Obama administration, from the White House, from HHS, we met weekly on the phone and talked about strategy, messaging, polling. And then we worked with groups that emerged, healthcare voter, little lobbyists. I don't mean to leave anybody out. You can name lots of them. And those folks did the important work. What I did was, because the president was at a point where he wasn't speaking up about Trump issues for reasons that I think make sense, it was sort of left to me to be the most visible person. I didn't, the thing, any part of this also is I don't really care if I burn a quote unquote bridge with somebody in Washington.
Right.
Like, my goal in life is not to be an insider. And I would never trade something that would help people for something that would maintain my access or a relationship. And I do think that's a little different about me than others. If, I will have a conversation with a senator or someone and they say something that I think is disturbing, unless it's shared with me with an understanding that it should be private, in which case I would struggle with it. But, I feel the obligation to, I feel no obligation to that senator. They work for us. I feel all obligation to help people. And, I'm not going to mark my life by how many insidery buddies I have. And I do wish more people did that. I'm not the only one that behaves that way, but I try to model that having powerful friends is a enticing kind of intoxicating kind of existence. Right. And so people don't want to blow it and they want to, you know, build these friends. And I was, you know, I have a little bit more, I don't really care what you think about me. I remembered having 130 million Americans counting on me and us to deliver healthcare services. And that's how I set my clock. And I was in a position to be able to do that because I had recently been in government and, you know, I had the privilege, as I said.
Would you, I would say God willing, but it's people willing, that Biden is our next president. If you were asked to serve again in an appointed position, would you go back or would you stay in this kind of public lobbying voice, like this public role that you're in?
Well, okay, first of all, I probably don't use the word lobbying, even though I could see why you use it. We're not paid lobbyists.
Right.
You know, I'm a 501c3 nonprofit. Quite honestly, I'd get in the room with anybody that wanted to solve healthcare problems, whether they were Republican, Democrat, or otherwise. Unfortunately, today, more Democrats want to do that than Republicans.
Right.
But I'm not quitting that hope. I mean, as soon as a Republican says for universal coverage, I say amen. You know,
yeah.
It hasn't happened. It hasn't happened a lot. It hasn't happened yet. But my goal is to help make it happen. In terms of your direct question, I think I'll go back and serve someday. Again, or maybe I will if it's the right role and if I'm asked. I think, you know, I do everything I can to have Joe Biden elected. I'll gladly help on the transition. But I think the key roles, particularly in healthcare, I have argued to him and to his team, need to go to people in marginalized groups.
Yeah.
I have recommended publicly that the head of HHS or the head of CMS be someone with a disability, because no one can know what that life is like unless they've lived it.
Right.
And if you can solve the healthcare system for people who have the most challenges, you'll do well by everybody else. And I think it's time. It's never happened. So that's my hope. So I would, you know, I'd love to help him. If he wins, I'd love to help him shape a great administration and a great agenda and be involved in every way, but I'm going to stay on the outside of that.
First, thank you for the clarification on the word lobbying. Cause it's hard, you know, like I'm not from that world. So for me, it's the only verb I can come up with that
right.
Describes the work you've been doing.
It carries a little baggage, but you know, it's funny when you say that, because what I say frequently is the pharmaceutical companies have their political representation in Washington. They're always at the table. The insurance companies have their lobbyists and they're at the table. The hospitals have their lobbyists and they're at the table. But by the table, I mean when people are deciding to finalize piece of legislation. Then I ask the question, okay, who's at the table representing, you know, like people?
Right.
And that's kind of, in that sense of the definition, like I do want to be the person and I'm willing to be, like to be, you know, people carving a role out for people at the table and their voices. And I don't pretend that I can represent anybody's voice. But our organization, United States of Care, spends a lot of effort and energy talking to regular, ordinary folks so that we are grounded in people's actual needs, not in kind of, you know, Washington policy, three-letter acronym speak.
Yeah, it does seem like the number of, you guys gave a lot of support to doing healthcare town halls and getting elected officials actually hearing from their constituents. And then you also did your own series of conversations, focus groups to actually understand what's happening in different states, because it is wild to me how state by state access to healthcare is.
Yeah. 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 And you know, there are a lot of patterns with a lot of big numbers, but there are so many unique, important, scary stories. And when you're in the middle of it, as most of us are at some point in our lives, you feel very vulnerable. I don't care who you are. When somebody's sick in your family, it's a really, really scary thing. And we've got to do better by people during those moments. And I'm willing to, you know, make a racket about it. But the things that I'm making a racket about are things I hear from other people, not necessarily, you know, my own either lived experience or, you know, brilliant ideas.
So the other thing I've been thinking a lot about this, this morning was I don't know if you've had the time to follow any of the news out of Lebanon the explosion that happened yesterday.
No, I have. I've been on TV yesterday and today. And so I've been on and around that story.
So I saw like the Al Jazeera TikTok of how chemical had been 6 years in the port. People had been trying to get it moved and the failure of government to address the concern. And to me, it is the same failure of government we're seeing now in COVID, only it was a true explosion, not this crescendo that COVID has been. And I just felt like they were the same problems of non-functioning government.
We would have been better off if there was one big explosion, because, you know, that's a situation where now I think there's 100 people dead and 4,000 people injured. And it's tragic and it's visual and it's visceral. And you're right, you can trace it to failures of government. We have 1,000 people dying a day.
Yeah.
That are invisible. And I don't mean this in any way to belittle the 100 people who just died. It's horrifying. But I'm also just tired of people who are like, yeah, you know, a lot of people die from the flu. So, you know, no big deal. It's like, that's a little bit of sociopathic thinking.
Right.
Right. That, you know, that's okay. People die from the flu, you know. I mean, it's like Al Jazeera getting on and saying, you know, 100 people died, but, you know, a lot of them would have died from the flu. I mean, we have this sort of weird lack of empathy that's really troubling in this country sometimes for other people's lives. And, you know, I wrote a thing today and it's in The Guardian. I don't know if it's come out yet. But by the time that your podcast goes up, it will be out. I was asked to write the dedication for the 1,000 healthcare workers who've died in the U.S. So far. And, you know, as part of the research that I read, you know, I was reading all their stories. I mean, I didn't read all 1,000, but there were a couple hundred of them that I got a chance to look at. When you start getting closer and you get away from the 1,000 people in day and like you look at like somebody's sister who like helped her sister with her whole life because she was shy and she's, you know, 39 and she just died because she was holding, you know, our hands and people in the ICU when they were dying. You know, I think we're totally missing the fact that there's a huge human loss, the human toll going on right now. And we seem to be a little bit asleep.
I do think people are missing. It's why in the 80s, when there was a famine in Ethiopia, it's why Save the Children would tell this. They would tell the story of like one child impacted by it and not the big numbers, because we, like, as human beings, we can connect to another person's story, but we can't, we lose the ability to grapple with the mountain of people that we're losing.
That's right. Especially because it's so true. And then you add to that, that, you know, unlike Lebanon, there are no cameras in these ICUs. There are no cameras in these hospitals. The news reporters, they may run a Chiron chugging up the numbers of people dead, but that's the presentation. You know, I mean, if God forbid you died or I died, the presentation of our death would be some CNN Chiron. We'd be part of some large toll, a very small, very, very small part of a very large number.
Right.
That's how our country is processing this right now.
Yeah, I think it's part of why, I don't know if you're familiar with Lori Kilmartin. She is a stand-up comic and a writer for Conan O'Brien. And her mother died of COVID. And she live tweeted the whole experience of having to do hospice over iPad and fighting to get into the hospital. And it was a really remarkable sharing of this isolation that people are facing at the end of their lives, because we can't get this, because we won't get this under control. I won't say can't, because I do believe we can, you know. One of the things that makes me excited is I see a lot of my friends who aren't in healthcare sharing your 4-week plan on Facebook. And so I'm seeing people who are so far away from from being involved in healthcare, that the 4-week lockdown message that you have of how, if we, of how we can move forward is resonating. It's really resonating. I'm seeing across the communities I'm involved in.
That's good. That's good. I mean, that's interesting to know. I mean, it's the sort of end of your end of the life thing you point to. And first of all, if you wouldn't mind tweeting, just DMing me the thread or emailing me that thread.
Absolutely, yeah.
It sounds really interesting. You know, I talked to Gretchen Whitmer, the Michigan governor. She was on the podcast a couple of months ago. And this is when things were breaking in the South. And I asked her, how do you communicate to the governors in the South who are at that point yet still not taking any action or much action? And she said, look, I've lost 3 family members to COVID. And let me just tell you what that experience is like. You take them to the hospital and they walk into the hospital and you never see them again. You don't see them in person. You can't identify the body. You may or may not even be able to have a funeral. That's it. And, you know, and we don't have anything, like that. And, you know, so, I mean, for people who are taking this lightly because they personally feel safe, you know, there's probably a variety of reasons for that. And we have to try to understand their thinking instead of just saying they're bad people. Some of it, I assume, is fear, hidden fear, because it's not a pleasant thing to think about.
Right.
Some of it is that their perceptions of COVID may be different. You know, if you're living in South Dakota, maybe your impression of COVID is the restaurant that your friend owns that closed.
Right.
And that's a tragedy, too, in a different way. And, you know, I try really hard not to villainize anybody. But still in all, even if you try really hard, there are people who are out there promoting really false messaging, including the president of the United States,
right?
Who's in a position to do something about it.
Yeah, I think the thing I try to remember is not to blame individuals for the failure of the system. You know, that when people aren't wearing masks or they think it's a hoax, like there is a level of personal choice in that, but it is a failure of our federal government and our state and local governments. Illinois aside, because Pritzker and Lightfoot have been phenomenal on COVID. I'm very happy to have voted for Pritzker.
Yeah, you finally have a good governor.
We have a budget. We have a governor. I was a very lukewarm voter when I voted for him, and he has been outstanding.
Right. I understand exactly.
I'm not a day goes by when I'm not shocked and in a good way about about what an impressive leader he is. So it makes me really happy for the state.
When's the last time you had a good governor and a good mayor?
Well, I would say that we don't have a good mayor right now. So
you're not a big Lightfoot fan?
I'm not a big Lightfoot fan. I think on COVID, she's handled a lot of things well. I think it's great news that the schools are not going to open. The schools are going to be remote in the fall. I think that's good. I think there's some research about that we never opened the beaches this summer, and all of the research about how important it is for people to get outside and exercise and get, and that we closed the lakefront this summer. The lakefront has never opened. And then I think she's got a problematic relationship with the police department. So
that's where you mark her down.
Yeah. I mean, what a difficult time to be a mayor in America. So she gets a mixed grade from me. I think Pritzker is obviously much better than his predecessor.
Yeah. Well, don't give up on her yet. I mean, it's probably one of the most challenging jobs in the country. And as I'm sure you know, the power of the police union is you just can't overstate the power of these police unions.
Yeah.
And I hear you on the frustration, and I think, you know, we need to keep applying pressure. But anyway, good to hear your reviews. Good feedback to hear.
So I'm the president of my synagogue, and I'm in a feast. Thank you. I've done my first year. I've got 1 year left in my term, but I'm in Facebook groups with clergy and cantors and other presidents of synagogues. And we're all planning for obviously remote services, recorded services. I just, if you have like any pep talk that we're making the right choice not to do Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in person this year. So just like a little pep talk about like for COVID, it's undeniable that we've made the right choice, but it's so hard to deny people the chance to pray together on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur this year.
Well, look, I mean, this is a year for maximum creativity, right? Yeah. So I think I would start with throw open the traditions and say, you know, what are the parts of our tradition that we have an ability to maintain and what's the best and safest way to maintain them? You know, if you're like everybody else, you've got a lot of older people in your congregation. And so, you know, job one would be to protect them. But, you know, there are elements of the ritual, particularly in the fall and on a nice day, where you can do things in place of, you know, you could do some perhaps things in person that are outdoors and in place of other elements of the service. You know, I think giving, you know, particularly Kaddish, I think you're finding a way to do some sort of recognition, not just of the people in the temple who died in the last year, but people around the country who have not been properly mourned. I think the way you phrase it is right. Find, you know, a dozen ways to give people a sense of connectedness that are different than the way they normally get them. And maybe some of them will even be better. You know, people drop stuff off at our house, you know, and while I don't get to see them, you know, there's somebody who listened to my podcast or read with one of my tweets and made a decision for, I don't remember what it was, but something about their kid, and it really helped them. And they found out where I lived, and they made homemade beer and dropped it off. And, you know, it was very touching. I felt like, yeah, I could feel that something went into that. When I say use creativity, I mean, you know, don't lose the spirit of what makes a holiday special, but find some like surprising ways for people to go, wow, you know, I took real effort. I took real care. I took real love. And therefore, while I miss some things, I got some other things. And by the way, next year, maybe you'd be like, can we do that again? Because that was awesome how we did this for people or whatever. So, you know, find those special touches. And my mantra is replace every negative with a positive. So if you can't do an X, don't just say, well, let's feel deprived. Let's say, let's do Y instead of X.
Yeah, it is very cool to see the creativity coming from synagogues, and I know that churches will follow as their holidays come up as well.
I'm glad you said. I think you're thinking about it. Great, you're thinking about it, right? The temple's lucky to have you there doing that.
Well, thank you for the time this morning. I know I just have a tiny podcast. Also, like in the bubble, I just had so much time on my hand with never leaving my house, and I needed an indoor hobby, so I started a podcast.
I'm honored to do it. I'm honored you asked.
Thank you. And if I were going to have you on a regular episode, what favorite thing, like in pop culture, would you have picked?
In pop culture, you know, I kind of like, what the heck is that? You know, I like a lot of public television dramas. Like, what was that one that was on a couple of years ago?
Downton Abbey.
In England, Downton Abbey. Yeah, like Downton Abbey, Treme, like a series like that. Treme is very different than Downton Abbey, but they both like live in their culture, right? And there's really interesting kind of almost plotting character development where, you know, not everything is part of a, you know, Law and Order plot where you're like, huh, but it's really, you're just watching people live in this sort of environment that they live in. You know, I really enjoy and appreciate those kinds of shows. You know, my wife and I are watching a lot of the like English and Irish, you know, mysteries now, mm-hmm. which getting a little bit formulaic, but still they're fun. So good escape at the very least, but also I feel like, you know, you can learn something and get transported a bit.
Yeah. Well, thank you and have a good day. Yeah.
Thank you, Leah.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of Finding Favorites. You can follow Andy Slavitt on Twitter at aslavitt, S-L-A-V-I-T-T. You can follow me, Leah Jones, on Twitter. I'm at Chicago Leah. Finding Favorites podcast is available on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher. Please rate and review and shoot me a tweet and let me know if you enjoyed this conversation with Andy Slavitt. Thank you. Stay home, stay safe, wear your mask, wash your hands.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.